and welcome to Sonic Talk episode 407, recording this very day on Wednesday the 17th of June 2015. Sponsors this week are Isotope, and if you want to stay tuned and see what they're getting up to, we will be giving away a copy of Ozone 6 and starting a new competition for another copy of Ozone 6, the gift that keeps on giving. So thank you very much to Isotope for their continued sponsorship of the show. Anyway, we've got guests, we've got a chat room. I want to say, actually, we'll say thank you very much to Dan in the chat room. Oh, no, that's not Dan. That's the chat room there. Dan in the chat room, who's here, he's installed some more robots to kick some spammers' behinds if they show up. So I think he's here for a bit of sport. So thank you, Dan. And also say thank you to all of our guests. And we'll start over here because we haven't had Mr. Doty on for a little while. And Mark has a beautiful backdrop of the ARP 2600. Mark, of course, Bob Moog Foundation, where he's the archivist, historian, evangelist, podcaster, demonstrator, kind of pretty much everything, pretty much, that I can see. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing very, very well. It's a little bit warm here, but beyond that, I'm great.
Do you want to take that jumper off? It's not a jumper,
well,
it's a t-shirt.
I know it would probably really increase the viewership, but yeah, I'm a little more modest than that.
Fair enough. Lycra is always the way to go if you're a bit worried about it. Save your embarrassment. Anyway, so Mark, thank you very much. You were at Sweetwater Gear Fest last weekend, and I want to have a chat with you about that, but I'm going to introduce some of our other guests first because I found that quite interesting. Anyway, we'll go in numerical order because there is Robbie Bronneman, who has just returned from the States. Robbie Bronneman, of course, is MD for Howard Jones, the Howard Jones Experience, which has been touring and has been just come back from the States, and also music producer, keyboard player, songwriter, studio owner, robot studio. Robbie, you actually, the last thing I think we said to you was you had to go and build a B-rig for the States because of the, if people haven't been watching. I wonder how that went.
So it went very well, apart from couple of days before finding out that all the spare parts and everything we'd sent over to America had been impounded by customs because we hadn't itemized every single item, which was like a box full of about 400 things. Like, you know, they wanted to know every single cable and every single this and that. Christ. So that was a little bit fraught, but got it all there. One little thing smashed and put it all together and it all worked. And I'd only forgotten one little loom out of the whole rig.
One little loom. Excellent. That sounds pretty good. So well done. Round of applause there, I think. That's what comes of planning.
It's a nice studio, Apogee. Apogee have got their own studio that Bob Clearmountain built for them. And we spent a couple of days in there setting it all up. It was very nice.
Yeah. Sounds great. Yeah. Anyway, Robbie, thank you very much for joining us. And we'll go to number three, who is Mr. Gaz Williams in Bristol. Gaz in his base attic, I think. I try and think of something amusing to call it every week, and I struggled this week. I felt more confident going into that sentence than I actually was.
Call it an absolute dump right now, though, because I've had to pull everything apart for some of the projects I'm working on, so everything is just chaos in here at the moment. But
Well, it doesn't look like it. Actually, your shot looks a bit like it's the soft focus of... You look like you might be leaning in for a kiss in a kind of sleazy 70s movie.
Oh.
No, it's all right. That's fine. Anyway, Gaz, I know that last week... you probably can't hear me. You're plugging your headphones in.
One moment.
Here we go. Yes, know that you did say it was easily unplugged and you have just easily unplugged it. But better than breaking it, I suppose.
Sorry.
There we go.
Back with you. Sorry about that.
So, Gaz, last Friday you played your synth orchestra space jam kind of gig at the local pub, which sadly I couldn't make it out. Andy, my business partner, did go and he said it was great. Was it great? Was it good?
Yeah, it was brilliant fun. I mean, it was so cool doing just really mind-bending, trippy, weird music to just regular pub punters. One thing I learned is that you have to calibrate your theremin. I didn't calibrate it before I did the show, and that was really so
a mistake.
It was a mistake. Nothing behaved as it should have behaved. It was all making it was a bit like a kind of like a bucking bronco or something, or
riding the Artoria. Yeehaw.
It's funny though, you know, the theremin, just by doing it, people are like, oh, wow, look at that, wow. You'd think that people would be over that a bit by now, but
not in real ale pubs in deepest, darkest Somerset, Gaz. You're not in the big smoke now, mate.
Yeah, good point. but yes, so note to anyone with a theremin, make sure you always calibrate it. Don't think that you can get away with not doing it. It was like all the scaling, everything was, because it just needs to interact with its environment, and you need to kind of have it set up. So yes, that was,
well, I mean, what, fair play for you doing it anyway. If I dash away from the mic, it's because Rich has just Skyped saying I'm having tech issues, I'll be with you as soon as I can. So he might show up at 1 minute, so if I run off, it's not that what you're saying isn't interesting, it's just that I have matters to attend to. but anyway,
yes. Yeah, so that was quite cool. It was an interesting gig in terms of, we were road testing this Holy Mountain soundtrack, and well, the bits of it that we've written so far for a show we're doing later on. And I mentioned it last week, but the Holy Mountain, if you haven't seen it, the Jodorowsky 1973 film, and Mark's seen it, is the so we're doing a live soundtrack to that, the Green Man Festival, and it's, I think we might have bitten off a bit more than we can chew with it. It's a mental mind fry of a film. So, yeah.
Right.
I'm
hoping that I get to see at least one of those anyway. So, Mark, I want to come back to you because you were at Gearfest, and we did a bit of tweeting out and following what was going on. It seems to have grown exponentially from last year, because I was searching out sort of hashtags of what was going on, and there was not very much, but this time there was a ton of stuff. So I hear it rained, but how was it? Was it like being at a music festival, intense and stuff, but with synths?
I suppose that is what it was like. It was very unique. It was like Nam on a desert island or something. I mean, it was just it was a pretty strange feel, and the rain was really hardcore. So there was a point where like there were rivers like flowing through the tents, and I think luckily everyone sort of expected that, so everything was up off the ground anyway. So it was just kind of a novelty to be sort of walking through the water and not a threat to your life, as some seem to be concerned.
I guess that's the advantage of 110 volts over 240, right?
Aha, yes. Had we been there, we'd all be dead. But it was really interesting and really fun, and there were a lot of great people there. It's just strange. Sweetwater is extremely awesome, but it's strange to be just in a tent, like with 10 feet away from you, there's Tom Oberheim. And then in the other direction, there's Dave Smith. And you're just in this basically parking lot with tents. And, you know, you could just walk up and talk to some of these great synth icons. I mean, it was really interesting.
I tell you what really tickled me, that one of the first images I spotted was the Dave Smith, Tom Oberheim, and Roger Lynn sitting at the back of a private jet being flown to Sweetwater. I must admit, the only thing about that, that's a great photo, but when I start hearing about any kind of company with private jets, it rings alarm bells, you know, because it seems like there's a little bit of excessive spending going on there, but that was pretty cool.
Well, I mean, in some ways, I think there is excessive spending going on, but I have to say Sweetwater, Sweetwater facility is like a paradise. And like all of the employees are super happy, and you just get the impression that everything is really awesome there, and that the money is going to great places. And I talked to Tom Oberheim about that jet thing, and he was just over the top thrilled that event happened. So it was pretty cool.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad it was fun. And they did say it, that basically they were saying, you know, if you kind of help us promote and keep an eye out on the Twitter feed, well, I'll put it to the clients that you might be able to get. We'll fly you over next time. So I'm hoping that will be the case, because I thought, well, for a few tweets, I'm definitely up for that, because I wanted to go because it's looking kind of pretty interesting. Robbie, you weren't there at the time, were you? You weren't in the vicinity, were you?
No, I would have liked to have gone. I'm sure there have been lots of things, all manner of Euro rack things I would have liked to have seen.
Well, probably saved you a few quid. Right, let's get on.
I did go to Analog Haven, it has to be said, though, in LA. So.
Oh, you bad boy.
It's literally just down the road. It's a crack den of Euro rack.
Yes, I can imagine. Right, let's start. Now, let me see. I've got this one here. This is the video I was going to play. Pop this in here, and we'll just play this. There we. Oh, we'll start here. This is. I think I've got. There we go. This is the. I don't know how the hell you pronounce this. This is the Klevgrand Production Corpressor, which is apparently named off a Swedish sausage, which actually you can kind of get. We're looking at the GUI. So you have the compression in the middle, I guess the gain or the expansion on the outside, and then the output makeup on the outside, on the right-hand side. So this is available for AU, VST, and also... oops, hold on, I need to stop that. And also for iOS, it works with AudioBus 2. Now, I was looking at that and I just thought that is a genius way of representing compression, because I remember when I'm starting out, and I still have trouble with it, you know, I look at it and the way that they're set up and the kind of understanding of them, it takes quite a while to get used to. And that, if that was around when I first started out, I would just think, brilliant, that's completely obvious what the heck is going on. I mean, I can't speak for how it sounds, but it looks absolutely great. I know, Robbie, you're you're regularly mixing and using compression a lot. I mean, this looks like a pretty cool visual aid to be able to set up a compressor. Or do you think you might just kind of make funny shapes and go with that setting just because you like the look of the shape?
Well, it's whether it falls into the edit by eye category when you start looking at waveforms, going, oh, that's a nice waveform, you know, and all, you know, you start doing all your editing without listening, a bit like a chef who doesn't taste anything. Chopping and tailing stuff without checking it because it just looks right and all that. I don't know. I'll give it a go. I'm interested. It's intriguing. I'll definitely give that a go.
It does look pretty good. I don't know, Gaz, for anything's sake, it would be a great educational tool, surely, just even in that.
I'm just in the process of buying it, actually.
Are you? Yeah. Are you buying the iPad version at $7.99 or the AUVST at $39.99, which was sort of harks back to...
The AUVST version is currently half price, so $19.99.
Right.
£13. And,
Robbie's off. He's going in.
I think it looks brilliant. I mean, I think... A lot of the time when I'm working, I want to work fast and I want to work spontaneously and I want to work creatively. And I do get bogged down with compression sometimes, and I get sometimes just a bit paranoid about it. Like, in terms of, I've always liked working with 1176s or LA2As or whatever, just having that much reduced sort of feature set, and it just sound pretty good. And just, or in the LA2A actually, isn't it just like kind of set and forget?
I do get a little bit scared by compression, and I still don't. I don't know what you think, Mark. I mean, I'm guessing you're working. I mean, you must bring things into the digital domain. I mean, you know, I'm sure everybody's got this sort of. You've got a valve reel to reel and a kind of an analog valve mixing desk. You don't touch anything digital at all apart from the final mix down into your videos. I'm sure that's not true. So you must have a DAW environment and what have you, right?
Well, the thing that I want to say about this is that the traditional compressor interface is terrible. It really doesn't tell you what's going on. There's so many like interface aspects about, for example, analog synthesizers that try to graphically represent what you're actually doing. And compressors, you know, they've got a couple of knobs and a button or whatever, and it does not tell me what I'm actually doing. So it took me years to kind of get a vague grasp on compression. So for me, this is ideal. This is fantastic because really it's a hard concept to really, I mean, most people are like, no, it isn't. But for me, it was a hard concept, and actually being able to see a physical representation of what is actually occurring, I think is fantastic.
Excellent. I'm very pleased that you said that too. I mean, I don't know what it sounds like, but yeah, it sounds like if you're getting, if it's going at half price, that's definitely, I'm not going to be able to check it out now because I'm working, so I can't possibly manage to buy something online at the same time. But yeah, good stuff.
I mean, just the fact it's called the sausage compressor, that does it for me.
It makes sense. In fact, what do they call it? They call it the smart dynamic hot dog device, I think it's called in one piece of text that I have. I don't know if that's that name, but I think that pretty much sums it up. So yeah, available iPad, AUVST, also works with Audiobus 2, so you've got settings saved. iPad version $7.99, AUVST version $19.99 for a limited period only. So it looks like a cool thing. Right, what's the time? Oh, yes, let's move on to our next one, which is this guy. This is something that you found. This is sort of taking, again, this is the EQ cheat sheet by Frederick Villeman, Fred V, via Cheatography. And it's just a breakdown of the frequencies, and it just seems like such a brilliant idea, to be perfectly honest. I really like... So, you know, you're starting off at under 30 hertz, which says virtually undetectable. It goes right up to 15K, adding we'll give a spark, but it breaks it down into bits that you can cut and boost and just sort of explains it a little. And I think that is actually particularly useful, particularly now we've got sort of GUI-based EQs where you can actually see what the frequency readouts are and what have you. And that really helps with the mixing kind of thing because, that's another thing. It's when you're starting out, you have to use your ears. And if you don't know what you're doing, it can end up in an awful mess. So what was it that you liked particularly about this, Gaz?
Partly, it was something that I wished I'd have had 20 years ago, you know, just because I felt so lost and so confused about things. And I think it's just very well written, and it really gives you a good starting point. And I think I will refer to it now. I mean, you know, there is a tendency to think, I mean, I've been doing this stuff for 20 odd years now, and it's a tendency to think that I know stuff, and I don't know if I do. I think I do. But when you see something else by someone else, it's quite nice as reassurance or just to try it. Or maybe I haven't thought about it that way. And I just think it's a very nice list. I recommend everyone have a little, you know, it's just a free thing to download, but it's, I think it's very well put together.
Yeah. Robbie, you still learning about EQ in your line of work, or do you have a fairly fixed, because I mean, you know, you work with a specific set of instruments and plugins that you get to know very well. So, I mean, you might not need any of this kind of nonsense.
I'm very into EQ. I spend a lot of time in my mixes, mostly getting rid of stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm absolute stickler for going through and analyzing everything and getting rid of stuff, you know, that's not needed, just to try and clear out the space. So you know, I always do a load of that before I do any boosting on anything. It's very useful to have a chart like that because it's good to kind of see another person's take on it. But you tend to, I know I can say frequencies exactly where they are and what I'm going to take out. You know, I just know, you know, after years of doing it, exactly what they sound like and where they are.
So, yeah,
you know.
I must admit, I got that through hearing feedback for live engineering. So I could spot, you know, right, that's 2K, that's 1.6, that's 800, whatever. That's where I got that. Not so much on the actual...
My kind of secret weapon of choice, has to have to say recently, is the dynamic EQ in the Isotope Ozone 6 Advanced. It's just brilliant tool for... you know, being able to create space without, you know, hacking stuff out permanently throughout our mix.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, that's only available in the advance. Funnily enough, we'll have a message from our sponsors very shortly on the very subject. Mark, how about you in terms of EQing? Are you kind of an instinctive EQer, or is this sort of thing going to be helpful?
I think, just like Gaz, I started off with nothing and just had to kind of, like, learn what EQs did. And started off, you know, certainly before... there was a lot of digital or computer related stuff going on. So it was all like, I just had to use my ears. And there are all these hilarious stories about me taking songs and like, I can make it have a really great low end if I just jack up all the low end and then bring the mid range down, you know? And I had all these recordings that I go back and listen to now. And it's like, oh my God, it's like a car accident. But throughout all the things I've done, like, some of these things I know, but some of them I don't know. And I'm like, I'm glad that this is laid out in this way. It's extremely helpful to kind of have an overarching structure upon which to sort of like start from there and then work your way into it. Because, yeah, EQing is an art.
Definitely, definitely. It's interesting, actually. I was thinking about this as my sort of my own journey through making sound. One of the things that really, you know, I was always quite, you know, you don't go full exchange of the knob, you know, you never get radical. But then one of the things that is actually really, really useful, particularly I noticed it in when you get presets for things like UAD stuff, channel strips, or Logic strips, or stuff in mixing desks like the Presonus desk or the Behringer desk, where you get various engineers with their presets for bass drums, snares, whatever, and you look at them and you think, Christ, some of that stuff is so extreme. You know, the level of EQ, cut and boost, and the compression amounts, some of it's really quite radical. And I guess, you know, that's something that you kind of learn. And so in many ways, you know, those sort of things are quite useful. I don't know if you found that, Gaz, when you're sort of taking those kind of presets in and kind of looking at them and going, oh, right, okay, well, that's interesting. That's much more extreme or less extreme than I would do. And it gives you a kind of a sense of scale, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I tend to be so much more minimal than them, and those presets I always think sound really weird and it never seems to work for me. But one thing I was going to mention, it was something that we talked about on the show years ago, was that Quiztones app. Remember that? It was, you can get it for the I know you can get it for iOS, but I think you can get it for OS X as well. And it's like a quiz. It's like a game show. It's a bit like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and it plays you tones, and you get multiple choice.
Thing here, quiz tones. All right, so you can just identify frequencies, sine waves.
and it turns it into a fun game. And it's two rounds. The first round, it plays you frequent. You have to work out what the frequencies are. And then the second round, which is the main part of it, really, it plays various instruments, and you can hear it like kind of raw, and then you can hear it with the EQ applied, and then you have to work out what EQ it is. And like that, the easy rounds are, it's like 10 dB of that particular EQ has been applied. And then the harder rounds are a 5 dB increase, or the hardest round is cut, what frequency has been cut.
Oh, and that's interesting.
But when you do it, it was quite fun. The first go I had, I did all right on it, but I played it a few times and I got really quite good at it by just really focusing on
harder. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So even though it's a few years old, I think it's still a really cool way of just acclimatizing yourself with different frequencies. And it's fun. It makes it kind of gives a framework for that fun thing, you know, because it can be quite a dry topic otherwise.
So it's
pretty cool.
Actually, well, it also gives you something to focus on as well, because that's the thing that's kind of quite hard when you just present it with a load of tracks. You go, I don't know where to start. So therefore, I suppose it gives you some. But yeah, what you were saying, Robbie, actually about doing a pass where all you're doing is cutting out the stuff you don't need, like high pass, low pass filters, pulling out, you know, excessive mid frequencies or whatever. That's a really good technique, actually, and a good place to start.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've used for years. I just always have a standard Logic EQ in linear phase mode strapped on and first channel strip, and just do all that first with that, and then tend to use my kind of more character EQs for kind of, you know, adding stuff to the sound after.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much. And this probably is a very good time to consider a message from our sponsors. It's funny, just before the show, I pressed the button a few times to make sure it happened instantly. There we are. Now it doesn't. Isotope 6.1, the de facto mastering suite of tools. Absolutely brilliant stuff. Get essential mastering tools, EQ, dynamics, maximizer, exciter, imager, post-equalizer, dither, dynamic EQ. This is the advanced version only. Harness the sonic texture of classic analog gear with deeper digital control. Master your audio within or outside your audio editing software. Work on a single track or the master mix or busing. Plug-in and standalone options now. Free update to Ozone 6.1 featuring adaptive release module, presets and more. And of course, all of their stuff comes with isotope.com/ozone. You get a 10-day free demo that you can download. So once again, we thank them very much for their sponsorship. And now we also have a winner from last week's competition. Let's see what happened. Last week, I asked you to hashtag out the mix to the max hashtag. This week, in fact, we got a winner. I probably forgot that bit. So we have a winner, and the chap is called Ben R, who is the Twitter handle at Squamish Sound, which is Squamish Sound. So congratulations, Dan. He added the extra comment, word lol, Not quite sure what what that exactly means, but good on you. Good economic use of the additional 100 characters that you've got in that. So we want to say thank you very much. If you get in touch, Ben R, and we will get the Isotope Fairy to drop you the code for Ozone 6. Right, and we've also got this week another competition, Isotope Ozone 6.1. You need to tweet the hashtag excellent audio, that's one word, and the hashtag Ozone 6 to at Sonic State and at Isotope Inc. So if I highlight that, that's what you need to tweet out to enter the competition. If you're listening in audio, I'll say that again, the hashtag excellent audio, one word, and the hashtag Ozone 6, one word with a number 6, to at Sonic State and at Isotope Inc. And obviously, you've got extra characters in there. Put a note in there. We do like to hear it, and quite often it provides a bit of light reading. I know the Isotope people watch it too, so any messages you have to them. Primarily seems to be fixated with people wanting to go on a date with the as-yet unseen Isotope Fairy. They obviously just... What more would you want in a woman other than being able to just give you free audio software, it seems to me? It seems to be quite a treat to many of you. Anyway, thank you very much for Isotope for entering... for sponsoring the competition, and thanks to everybody who entered, and good luck everybody. Right, let's see, I've got to go back to my other notes, because I did rather mess that up a little bit. Right, okay, EQ cheat sheet, where's... oh yeah, this is bonkers. Now this does introduce a wider... right, so this is the drop machine, and this first... I saw this on Create Digital Music, Peter Kern's excellent site, and this is basically, if I play this, basically the drop machine is a piece of experimental software that analyzes the audio and figures out where the drop is. Right, I won't... there's lots of examples in there. And obviously, you know, if you're an EDM fan, you're going to lots of clubs, or you're just into that kind of hyped sound, you know, the drop is kind of the key moment in a lot of these tracks. Obviously works in loads of other... Pixies, for instance, have a lot of drops in their stuff, but perhaps not as intense as some of those things. But the thing that's really interesting about this is by a chap called... he's called Paul Lemaire, and he went to the Medium... Hack Day. And if you're not aware, Medium is like a music festival, industry festival based in Cannes in France, where labels and publishers and artists and what have you get together and kind of do stuff. And they had a Hack Day, which is kind of what could you figure. This was introduced by Spotify. So what Paul did is he took... there's all of this information in the scrubbing. If you're listening to a Spotify track and you fast forward to find the drop or certain parts, it logs it to somewhere on the Spotify servers. He analysed all of this per track and came up with these kind of quite accurate maps of drop maps for various things. This is interesting in a number of ways, because it's kind of A, the sort of science of the music, which is quite interesting, but B, the level of granularity of information that we're getting out of this. I don't know what this means exactly, but I mean, one of the things for me, it really reminds me a little bit of... you know, if you remember post-punk or just pre-punk, when, you know, there was a lot of pub rock and glam rock and prog rock, and it was getting a bit kind of the same. And it feels like this, if this is being able to be analysed by log files, we must be just before something big happens in music, surely. And this is the one thing that, I mean, there are a number of issues with this, really. And I'm just curious, Robbie, I mean, you produce quite a lot of, I guess, stuff that would fit into this genre, because, you know, your gig is to produce kind of happening electronic sounds for artists and kind of help to make that stuff. I mean, what do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, if I look back, I mean, certainly when I was doing a lot of trance and a lot of trance remixes for artists and stuff, if I look back on the body of work that I did over that time, there's kind of always like almost like you could almost put them against each other and you would know. You know exactly where you have to have the first kind of little moment, kind of very small drop to kind of tease people, and then where you're going to put the main event, where you're going to drop in the vocal hook or the synth hook or whatever. And it's interesting, because when you've done a lot of music like that, and you've been to the clubs a lot and seen how mixes that you try to do that have kind of move away from the norm don't tend to work very well, you realise that clubbers and people like that are creatures of habit, and they kind of are kind of, they're kind of, it's like being on a hamster wheel. Everyone's kind of conditioned for that kind of, you know, waiting for those events. And it's funny, because I stopped doing a lot of that kind of remix work because in the end I kind of got a bit bored with it because I just felt like, you know, everything was a bit interchangeable. And occasionally I'd go back and listen to stuff that's going on now, and it's still, for all intents and purposes, pretty much the same. You know, so it doesn't, people don't change. The listening public don't change.
No, I suppose not. I mean, the thing that I've noticed that has changed, certainly in pop, is it moves away from the classic intro, bridge, chorus, middle eight, you know, all in the same place. The arrangements have become a lot more inventive, but essentially the dynamics in this situation are not. I know, Mark, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think you're right, but when you analyse every kind of genre that comes along, whether it be trance, progressive house, you know, tech house, whatever, all these things that come along, you know, dubstep, you know, all these things, within those genres, once there's an established form, most people follow that established form until the next genre comes along.
Mm. I guess that cycle becomes quicker and in many ways. And then, Mark, I'm guessing, did you enjoy the EDM clubs of Indiana while you were at Sweetwater? Do they differ from the ones in Asheville?
Actually, I don't attend any of them, so I don't actually know. But the thing about electronic dance music is that it's like a derivation of all music that has preceded it, and a focus on the very most functional, motivating parts of music. And I think this is really interesting because, you know, in Romantic era music, where dynamics became such a deal, it was really evident that dynamics could really affect the emotions of the people listening. And I think that's one of the aspects of electronic dance music, is it really has located the very functional and seemingly inherent psychological responses to musical input and uses them in such a focused way that, like, they affect everyone in sort of the same way. And I wonder what the psychological basis is for the drop. Why do we all respond to it? Even I don't even really listen to EDM anymore, but when I feel it building up, you know, it just affects you emotionally and physically. It's a weird psychological
thing I guess
we seem to all share.
I guess so. It's the intensity. I guess the intensity in a lot of club mixes, even though there may be a lot of simplified elements, it builds to a point of almost, you know, almost too much, and then you get the release. I think that's the thing, and it's the amount of dynamic there is there. I know, Gaz, if you this does raise a lot of interesting questions about A, what this guy did, and also, you know, what it means to in terms of, are we really all that predictable?
gosh, I mean, yeah, go around some of the festivals and there is a definite sameness to a lot of stuff, and you kind of, I'm always looking for interesting, different things that move me. And when I get really bored very quickly, and when things become recognizable, and it's, I completely relate to what Mark's saying. And there is a kind of something that you can't deny with it. But I've had so many experiences within the dance music world of ignoramuses and stupid stupid people, thick, stupid, artless people. sorry, I'm getting really... I was thinking, actually, I went to see Underworld recently, and they're so classy, you know. They don't resort to sort of cheap little techniques. They sort of do things in such a cool, kind of enveloping way that, you know, and subtleties and dynamics come in different ripples. And I was so impressed. It was so good. They still got it. You know, a lot of people who make dance music, a lot of people are amazing, and there's loads of talented, amazing dance producers, but like there's like a kind of mainstream load of people who do it, and they're, in most cases, people you just really wouldn't want to know.
That's a bit harsh. I think that's a bit harsh.
Be fair, it's been most of the big, like the massive names who you know, who are sort of DJ stroke producers, they have ghostwriter producers anyway, so perhaps you would want to know them.
Well, maybe so. I mean, I think the thing that I find quite interesting about this is, you know, there's a number of other issues here, which is all of this data that is being collected by a streaming service like Spotify. I mean, God knows how many streams they stream, you know, a year, a day, a second, a minute. It must be lots. So all of this stuff that's being written to log files. I mean, I don't know what else is being written to those log files, but presumably all of this relational stuff. I mean, and even with all of this amazing kind of technology, there's a danger. Is there a danger they'll ever make any money? And for the artist, because I mean, some of the figures that you hear are just hilarious. You know, they're almost comedy. It's, you know, 34 million streams. I earned $1,000, and just think, what the hell is that all about? But I guess that's for another time. But the other thing is the fact that are we in danger of getting to the point where, you know, labels get access to that data in return for their favorable rates using Spotify, and then they start to A&R and steer the artist into the right, okay, it needs to be between 50 and 52 seconds when the first drop, otherwise you aren't going to be speaking the right language to the listeners. And it just does it, maybe, I mean, because obviously you get this zeitgeist, which is what you were talking about, everybody does the same thing, but when it becomes formalized into a formula that the people driving the business require, that's the thing that scares me a little bit more than anything else. I take it by the silence, everybody just completely agrees with me. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Sorry.
But yeah, anyway, it's an interesting thing. And obviously this guy is a very smart guy. And the other thing that's interesting, you know, it could be used for good. I don't know. You know, maybe the fact that you can experiment. And obviously we're talking, this has a very visual look to it. I mean, I think if we scroll forward, there are other tracks which have, you know, they're all quite similar, though some of them have very extreme curves. That one is obviously nothing to the curve at the beginning, and then this sort of beauty. You might get to the situation where I think it was like Chris Clark, Body Riddle guy, he was making sounds to make an oscilloscope look good. You know, so you've got these kind of different criteria. It's just an interesting thought. Again, introducing the visual aspect, I wonder if there's people who would maybe kind of turn it around and make something kind of interesting. Go, okay, this is a new curve and that's the curve template. Perhaps there'll be a way where, you know, some bright spark in a DAW will be able to get, right, I've got 16 tracks full on all the time. And what it does is create these kind of dynamic curves that you can overlay on them through automation or whatever. Anyway, I'm rather rambling there, but interesting.
Well, so who are these people? I mean, this is my nightmare. There are people who actually will load up a song and then just fast forward, scrub right to the part that they like. To me, that's my like worst nightmare. We spend all this time like creating these elaborate songs that have developments and additions, and we're like, it's a story we're telling through music, and then there's someone going, okay, this is the part that's good. You know, it's kind of a nightmare.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, there is that. I mean, that is a very valid point. But then, you know, there are certain favorite parts of specific songs. I mean, I don't know how. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
You know that new audio format the Native Instruments have done.
Oh, the stems where thing.
Perhaps we're going to get to a point where you don't even have to buy a song from an album now. You can like pick a song. You can just pick the section of a song you want to buy.
Loop it forever. Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Although in many ways, if you think, I mean, although, you know, it does interest. I mean, looking at that curve, it looks like a massive dynamic curve. But if you looked at the actual waveform of the song, that dynamic change would be, you know, minimalized to a very small amount. Toothpaste with a little blip in it rather than kind of, you know, a big empty spot. So I guess there's quite a lot of probably go on about that for ages. But anyway, I won't do because there are other topics as well. But that was a great, just a lot of things to talk about. Right, okay, well, let's now move on to this one because this is also quite interesting. This is Modulince. This is a kind of environment. I guess it's a bit like Reactor in some ways. Allows you to introduce modules and just drop in various different points. And then add, you've got an input and an output, but you can also utilize it. Let's see, I've got the web page here somewhere. This is obviously just an audio file that's being looped and granularized. And it was quite interesting. I won't play the whole thing. In fact, I'm not going to play the whole, but this is the website. And it's basically also got a DAW built in, so you can pipe this audio into these various building blocks. It's just another interesting way of looking at things. I think this thing is $100. It's only Mac only, I'm afraid, but that's it for now. I seem to have lost Gaz, so I'll come to you Robbie first. I know you're always interested in sort of new ways of processing sound. Some of this looks quite interesting, actually.
Yeah. No, I really like the look of, I like the concept of it. I don't like the fact that it's white like that. I find I have a real problem with software like that. If it was the other way around, if it was dark on, you know, with white writing against it, I think it's much easier to work with. I mean, that's a small cosmetic point which they could probably create a switch to allow you to have a dark or light interface.
Yeah, like reskin it possibly.
Yeah. it looks a bit sort of PC look like that, paper white. But I like the idea of that. I'm definitely going to check that out.
Okay. Gaz, so does this have a... This did look pretty interesting, doesn't it? Oh, God, I'm saying interesting so much. I'm gonna have to...
I like the fact that it's got support for the Leap Motion built into it.
Yeah.
That seems pretty cool. It's a lot easier on the eye than Reactor, though, I think, isn't it? It's kind of got a very... I quite like the whiteness of it myself, but It's just got very clear. I can understand it a lot more. I think it's got a nice look. I think the built-in DAW thing is really clever as well.
Just in terms of record directly into it, yeah.
And then I wonder whether you can just bounce stems out of that easily. I guess you must be able to. It's good, isn't it? It looks really good. This is kind of coming at a point in time for me where I'm spending as little time in the computer as possible. So, however, the Leap Motion side of it does kind of draw me into it a little bit, because I've got my Leap Motion here. We talked about it, I think, on the last show, and still looking for the killer app, the killer thing for it. So maybe this might be quite cool.
Yeah, well, if you want to check it out, it's modulince.com. But, Mark, I know you're more of a hardware kind of guy. I mean, I'm guessing it's entirely possible that you might be able to at least control some of these devices via MIDI control or hardware control in some ways. And it's just, the idea of being able to granularize and do all of these things and bring in, again, it looks like it might be a useful teaching tool if you don't have hardware versions of all that stuff to your hands too.
I think one of the, whenever you see me looking over here, I'm actually looking at the computer screen that it's up on. So I'm not I'm not losing interest or something. but no, I think anything where you have people making conscious decisions about a progression of changes or synthesis like this, I think it's a good thing, because you're engaging people. They're actually being responsible for the creation of their own work. And I think that's fantastic whenever that occurs. It's not, you know, anything that steers people away from presets and shows them exciting ways to be the author of what they're doing. It's educational and it's more creative.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I agree in many ways, you know, for some of us, you know, and there is a general move away from sitting in front of the computer to do stuff. So it's going to struggle a little bit with what is currently going on for a lot of people in terms of, you know, people getting into hardware modular is definitely good. I just wanted to say that CR78 in the chat room also mentioned that Bitwig 1.2 beta released yesterday, which I'm guessing will have quite a lot of interface changes, because we know that's an ongoing development as well. So, I mean, it'd be interesting, because I know when we first saw Bitwig, there was a very similar kind of level of almost sort of more in the reactor kind of granularity, where you could get under the hood and take apart VSTs and build synthesizers almost to a component level and routing, and then sort of flip it over so you only see the front end. And I don't know if that's going to be interesting. Said it again. I need to have some kind of I need an app that can detect I'm about to say it. I'll have to just think a bit harder. But this does look good, definitely. And I would like to try. I'm not sure if I want to drop $100 on it, but I'm going to drop them a line and see if I can get it to use it. Because yesterday I upgraded to Yosemite on this Mac here, which has been something that I have not done. I've been on 10.8 for probably 18 months, 2 years, and then 10.7 before that. So now I should be able to run all this stuff. In fact, I did actually run up Persona Studio 1 version 3, and that was pretty good. I like the look of that. But everything, so I just want to say, if you're worried about doing that, what I did, just for anyone who's interested, I put an external hard drive on Thunderbolt. I installed Yosemite in it. Then I pulled my entire Mac, you know, everything, just Migration Assistant, yeah, just put it all on there. Then I booted from that and ran for most of yesterday and some of today. And stuff worked. I mean, it just absolutely worked, which I thought was brilliant. And then what I ended up doing is I just took the old drive out of this machine and put that one in its place. And now I will back up the old drive, so I've got a copy of my working system before. But yeah, so far, so good. I don't know if anyone else has had it.
Just a quick note on...
Oh, Gaz, yeah.
Sorry. I did, before we moved off modulin.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, unless you want to move on.
No, it's okay. I just noticed you're degrading. You're bit reducing. Yeah, you're fading away. Like Dorian Gray in the attic.
I don't know what's going on. Just having a deep look at modulins. The modules look incredibly nice to use. The sequencers, and there's like a looper, I'm quite interested in this. I think it does a lot of things right, actually.
Oh, here we go. Look. There's all the individual modules.
Yeah. There's a real clarity to the logic. You know, they're very easy to sort of, you can see how to use them straight away just by looking at them.
They're like advanced little bits.
I think it is a bit like that, yeah. Now, what would be interesting to me is just what do we know anything about the MIDI capability of it then?
No, not as such.
How mappable it is. Because if that stuff is very mappable, if it's got a really, really deep MIDI implementation, I think this looks like a winner. Yeah, sorry, that was my tuppence anyway.
No, I think that's a fair point. I think that's well worth it. I can't remember what I was going to say. Anybody else had to upgrade recently? Because I can recommend... Sorry?
I'm thinking about it. I'm on 10.9.5, and I've been stuck on that for a good year and a bit. I've been told that the migration from that to Yosemite, or Yosemite, as I like to call it, just
Yosemite Sam. I said.
I sound really ignorant about it, and everyone tries to correct me all the time, which I find quite funny. Yosemite. Yeah, I've been told the upgrade from Mavericks to that is pretty painless, so I think I might give it a go.
It seemed it.
It's on my system has never been more unstable. I have to say, this Mac Pro I've got on Yosemite, I don't know quite what's doing it, but I'm getting more crashes and all sorts of kind of issues now. So, but I don't know why that is. I suspect there's something rogue in my system, some USB driver or something. But yeah, so I would be a bit hesitant if I hadn't already done it, if I'd have known what to happen.
Well, I'm still on. I'm on a 2011 Mac here, so it's not going to be a hardware compatibility issue. And Mark, do you run Macs where you are, Mark, or are you on PCs?
Oh, I am a diehard Mac fan. I've had over 40 Macs in my life, which is sad because my current is a 2007 running a truly vintage operating system, 10.6.
Good for you.
I'm terrified of upgrading because I know everything's just going to fail. So I think I might just save this computer and just let it be and then get a new computer and just go that route because, you know, it's old already. Awful. And there's a bunch of stuff that I'll never be able to use again if I upgrade. So, you know, I think I'll just get a new computer.
That's one way of doing it, and that's what I've done in the past as well. Or when I'm doing that, I just kind of try and freeze it in time. But yeah, it does. I think the thing for me is, you know, I when I went to see Apple at NAMM, and they were talking to me about Logitech, and I just thought, I feel really embarrassed to say that I can't actually run it on my current computer because I haven't got the right operating system. So I installed this, and I've just written to them, said, okay, right, give me the Logitech X install now, please, and I can see where I go, because that looks like it'll be worth checking out.
One little thing I've just thought, which I saw this week, I saw that Apple have announced a new kind of synth in GarageBand, which looks very much like the remnants of Camel.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, Camel, I think that's Alchemy. Right.
I'm guessing that's going to make its way as a more fully fledged thing into the next version of Logic, reading between the lines.
Yeah, that's let's have a look. I don't know if I've got I can't find a web page to throw out. But yeah, I read something along those lines as well, and that looked kind of good. And I know, Gaz, you're very... I wonder if it'll use the old preset. I mean, it's an interesting thing. Oh, God, I've done it again. The thing about that is, you know, so you want to add a instrument to GarageBand, you buy the company. I mean, that just seems... That tells you a lot about how much effort goes into developing something like this. So it's cheaper to buy the company than it is to develop your own thing, I suppose. But it is Camel Audio, apparently.
Well, yeah, and when you see the screenshot, it... you know, and it has got the remix pad, the kind of 8 segments which you can move around to morph the sound on. Which
here we go. This is on Apple Insider. Yeah,
there is. It looks incredibly like it.
Oh God! Well, it does, doesn't it? A bit.
But it looks like that's what you know. You call up a patch, and the only parameters you can adjust is that thing. It looks like you just move it around. Now, within that, I've always thought that with Alchemy, though, the amount of sounds you've got when you move around that remix pad or whatever it's called, is pretty vast. But it looks like that one. It looks like you can't get any of the parameters, though. It's just like a preset.
Let's have a look.
That you can... Of course. I mean, that's the ethos, isn't it, with the GarageBand thing? I think it's just a sign of things, isn't it?
Yeah.
GarageBand's like sort of a little entry into the candy store, isn't it, to go into Logic, and then ultimately
gateway door if that makes sense. Excuse me. Okay, well, that was Modulance. This one's for you, Mark. Right, let me see if I can find that image now. What is your favorite waveform? Now, this was posted by the guys at Audio Animals, who are a record label mastering service, do online mastering, mixing, and what have you. And it was just came up on Facebook, and it's what your favorite waveform? It seems on the face of it a very simple question, but I saw a number of answers in the comments of various things, which were like, well, okay, that actually shows, you know, okay, well, that's interesting. And I'm not going to prejudge this, but I'm going to you first, Mark. Just because you are Mr. Analog, obviously, on the panel anyway. So what would you say? So what have we got there? We've got we've got sine wave, square wave, triangle, and sawtooth. Triangle, I've always felt, is a bit pointless to me, really. I mean, you can always, you know, filter something down to get triangle, like a square, for instance. I don't know. What do you think, Mark?
I answered this in a... irritatingly hipster internet know-it-all jerk way. I was like, well, my favorite is the sawtooth triangular, which, as some of you might know it or not, probably not, so I can say, yeah, I knew this and you didn't know. Anyway, it's one of the waveforms on the Minimoog that didn't become one of the waveforms that people put on all synthesizers. It's only present on the Minimoog. I keep looking at the Minimoog. And so I was like kind of doing this little code. I have a Minimoog and it's got this cool wave. No, I really actually do like that waveform.
Well, is that the transition between the triangle and the sawtooth then? Is that that? So it's... Well,
yeah,
could you describe the shape of that, please, with your finger?
it's like if you took the... No, I... But yeah, it's a combination of a triangle wave and a sawtooth wave. So it actually is kind of like a triangle on the top, and then it has a sawtooth ramp going off from it.
Effectively, it's that rather than that. So it's got that angle, yeah? So it's... Right, I think I understand. Okay.
My actual answer, and I think someone put this, I don't know if it was your post of this or someone else's post of this, someone put sine wave because it's the only one you need.
Yeah,
and
because you can
I
make,
like that because
well, you need a lot of them.
Synthesis fan.
You need a lot of them to be able to make all those other waves. But yeah, that's a fair point. Robbie.
I was thinking about this earlier. I mean, it's hard to say, isn't it? Because each one has its own unique thing that it can do for, you know, certain types of sound. I do like a nice square wave. Get a nice solid sound with square wave quite often. I like that. So always add those into basses and stuff.
Yep, yep. And also, of course, with square wave, there is pulse width, which is, as you know, is one of my favourites. But I quite like pulse width in... Or what I actually like is the synths that allow you to modulate, like the Moog variable waveform, where you can actually... God, I said Moog right. That's a where you can modulate between waves, and you get this kind of twisted pulse wave kind of vibe, and I really like that. And there was one synth. It was the Poly KB, which was Zill synth. It was the something. I'm trying to remember what it was. And that has the most radical kind of morphing wave sound that I like. But yeah, I don't know if it might be Square. Gaz,
I like it. I like the humble triangle, and it's always very pleasing and comforting. You know, it's like a duvet of the waveform. it's just lovely. It makes me happy. It makes me content in life. But, you know, when I want to kind of rough things up, and then I venture into the more dangerous area of the sawtooth, then, you know, and then sort of that's the, you know, that's always quite exciting. And
the brassy harmonics of a sawtooth are particularly special. And obviously, I mean, yes, in the same way that you would say a sine wave or multiple sine waves could make you any waveform if you had enough of them, sure. The sawtooth has an edge to it, which is it gets the majority, or certainly a heck of a lot of classic synth tones, but also the fact that you can obviously filter it down and get closer to a triangle and closer to a sine just by, you know, by a judicious use of the filter, I guess. You can't, and I do quite like the way that, and now I'm trying to remember the synth I've reviewed recently, which had pulse width on the sawtooth. So you ended up with this kind of, you end up with doubling. So you bring in an octave harmonic through a fifth. I think it might be the Arturia actually that does that to a degree, isn't it? But I don't recall. There's something on it, but it's particularly lovely. But that was a bit of fun. So if you want to check, I will, let me just bring up the website, because they provided the topic. Audio Animals Limited. Yes.
Can we have the same question again, but referring to LFO shape?
Yeah, well, that's true. If you're I should have qualified that with oscillator, obviously, and LFO. Now that is interesting, because there is quite a lot of difference between a sine and a triangle, in terms of the sound. And I, for one, what's really interesting, you don't get that many sine wave oscillators on modern synthesizers, LFOs on modern synthesizers. You generally have a triangle, at least up to recent years anyway. And so in many ways, that kind of amplitude ramp and the way that that it reaches the peak of drops is a very familiar sound, whereas a sine somehow sounds more polite somehow. I don't know. What do you think about that, Mark? That's a good question.
I find myself... Well, I mean, it depends on the synthesizer, of course. My favorite would have to be a lag affected sample and hold. That's the one. If I have that available to me, that's what I will almost invariably use as an LFO. But on more limited synths, I really like what I call a saw, which is up and then down.
Like ping,
I call
ping ping, so you get that hard edge.
Ping, ping, ping. Yeah, that's my favorite.
That's really good for riffing stuff, and I particularly like the square wave for modulating pitches, so you get stepped, so you can create sequence kind of lines off it. I'm hogging all the waveforms. Robbie, what's yours?
I'm always a sucker for a good old sample and hold. I do enjoy sounds with that on. So I mean, you know,
you can't use it. You can overuse it though.
You can overuse it, but they're nice. It's nice when you modulate a filter and stuff with it, as opposed to just, like, you know, doing that sort of science lab kind of thing.
One thing I haven't checked out is what happens when you get audio rate modulations with sample and hold. What does that create? Does that create a kind of a harder edge? Because, I mean, depending on when you what wave you're using and how, like, square wave brings in those extra harmonics. What happens, Mark? What happens in the...
Well, what you have basically is such random voltages happening so quickly that you essentially get kind of a weird, gritty noise. And if you have it lag processed, then it just basically is noise.
Right. Is that pink generally, or does it have a particular color? Now we're going to get technical.
I'm going to guess that it's probably white, depending on what your filter setting would be or what you were modulating. I would imagine that, well, I don't know. That's a good question. It depends on the range of the LFO.
I don't actually know what the difference is in the generation of different types of noise. Is it filtering, or is it the way that the randomness is generated?
Yeah. It's emphasis, isn't it? Ah. I mean, typically, pink noise has more of an emphasis in the lower frequencies, so we, through psychoacoustics, are more aware of them. Because those frequencies are present in white noise, but because we have a tendency to identify the higher frequencies more readily than the lower frequencies when the higher frequencies are present,
right?
We do, but pink noise kind of, I guess, maybe attenuates the high frequencies a little bit more so that we can sense the, but I don't know what red noise is, so...
Brian, yeah, well, what's quite interesting about this, and now we've sparked a discussion in the chat room about people's favourite noise types, but Gaz, what was your favourite LFO waveform shape then?
Cool. It's one of those things, isn't it? I mean, I do love the triangle again, really, just purely because it's, for that comforting. Oh, I'm going blocky again. Help.
It depends on the amount of depth you can apply, doesn't it? Because I know you've got a system one there, you'll find that the IRA does not have very much depth on the modulation, certainly for the filter. So you can't get really snappy and high. You're doing sort of 25% rather than 100 plus or minus 100. And that's something that is a bit unfortunate in that particular side. So it depends on how much depth you can apply for the LFO, I think.
Mm-hmm. But really, oh, it's hard to pick a favorite, though. It is hard to pick a favorite. It would have to be, what is your favorite LFO shape affecting the filter? What is your favorite LFO shape?
Now you're getting really specific. Now we're getting absolute macro nerd.
Yeah.
People are leaving the chat room in droves.
Oh, I'm not sure that's true, but they might be shortly. But yes, okay. Well, some interesting questions read up there. And let's see, favourite waveform. We've got some other things as well. What's the time? I don't know if we've even got time for it. What is the time? 5:10. We might have to leave it there, actually, because we could very quickly just do this, because this was another thing that was posted. This is by a guy called Applied Science.
In my shop, I've wanted to make animations with it, showing video taken through the microscope. And I've also been thinking about different recording media lately. So I put the two together this weekend and came up with this. This is an animation that shows a phonograph needle riding in an LP groove. So in this video, I'm going to talk about how I made this and some other recording technologies. The first step is to head down to the...
Wow, that is so awesome. So this guy, basically, Applied Science, is a YouTube channel. He's got an electron microscope, lucky him. So he did vinyl... And he did, what was the other thing he did? He got some, obviously he couldn't put a record into the electron microscope, but he managed to figure out a way to do it. Then he tried CDs, which was quite interesting as well. Oh, I said it again. God damn it. Let me see, where is it? Oh, I thought he had. Yes, he looked at the pitting of CDs and DVDs, which are absolutely really tiny, tiny amounts of bit ones and zeros. And I've never really kind of been, thought about it, but I guess these are all etched as well. Just a really nice kind of taking it back to the science part of it. I know I don't have much vinyl, and I don't think... Remember there used to be those people who could look at records and know what they were just by studying the grooves? This takes it to an...
The grooves in a record should be at least similar to the waveforms you see on your computer screen. I mean, if you could get in close enough to look at them, they should look like the same thing, maybe not with a variance in amplitude, but a waveform is a waveform. And it depends on the record is stereo, then you're going to have to look at the top side of the groove or the bottom side of the groove, but the waveform should be the same. So if a person has that good of vision, they should be able to discern that, which I think is
Pop
terrifying.
Says, Pop says in the chat room, I recognize the pits in the CD. It was Musical Youth. Good for you. Even if it's not true, it was great. But yeah, very nice. But it's
the
good.
The thing that was so cool about that video, if I could just say super quickly, were video discs. I don't know if you guys ever got
Laser discs.
Is that video discs, which are different than laser discs. And he talks about them in that thing. They're the ones in the big plastic caddy that slide out. And it's actually video read by a needle. And I always wondered how in the heck that was possible. Wow. My dad had one. I still have the one he had. I've got one video disc for it, which is ELO at Wembley. But anyway, and it actually reads by capacitance differences in depth. And it's video. It's video read by a needle.
Wow, that's really awesome. I mean, I suppose the thing is with, I don't understand how they make it stereo. That still kind of blows my mind a little bit. I know, Robbie, this is something fun. You fancy electron microscope? I think you've got room over there. I can see a space behind you.
No, but I'm just laughing at what Mark said, because my uncle, who used to own a chain of hi-fi shops in the 80s, I remember he had one of those machines with the disc. And I think I remember sneakily watching his Confessions of a Window Cleaner on it. That was one of the only films he had, which is a kind of 70s carry-on type film.
Was that, it was colour, presumably, was it?
Yeah, it was colour, yeah. And it
what was the quality of the image like? I mean, I can't imagine you noticed much, but...
funnily enough, when we came to remaster Howard's back catalogue, there was one mix that had been done by Godley and Cream, which was like a video and mix they'd done, which was actually banned from the BBC, because basically what they'd done was they'd cut loads of fake advertising in and out of the song.
Blipverts.
Fake the parts of all the people in the adverts. And everyone on television just used to think something had gone wrong with it. So it was basically that nobody would play this video. But when we came to remaster the albums, there was that mix we couldn't get because Warners had lost it. And we didn't even have any version of it, and somebody came forward who had a laser disc of Howard's early videos, and that was the best quality copy we were able to extract for that one mix for the bonus features. So it was much better than what was available on analog, as it were.
What did laser discs run at? Does anyone know? And the audio, because they used to be the kind of before we got into DVDs, they were the. In fact, there was Voyager was a company based in New York that used to do laser discs, and they got into CD-ROMs. In fact, my only CD-ROM publishing deal was with Voyager, and they'd made all their money out of laser discs. And they always were saying, "Would you like one?" But I never had a player or anything. I was always angling for one. But I don't know what the audio quality was on them. I guess it must have been some form of digital, right? Unless it had an audio. Right. Probably 32K or something like that, I'd imagine. Probably not CD quality, perhaps. I don't know, Gaz. Well, so this was a cool little video, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. It's amazing. We're so lucky these days, aren't we, to have this abundance of brilliant things to watch all the time. And
well, this show would be nothing without him, I can tell you.
I don't know what to say. Great. Everyone should watch it.
Yeah, definitely. And if you, he's on Patreon, in fact, and he's currently doing pretty good. He gets $400 a video. And I did spot in the about that, which isn't bad, actually. $400 a video on Patreon is pretty good, because I was watching something else, which was a sort of, I can't remember the name of the guy, and he had all of his videos, he had 300,000 subscribers on YouTube, and all of his videos would get kind of regularly 100,000 to 200,000. And he only had 30 people supporting him on Patreon, which is really depressing when you think if that's the most you can convert and he makes good stuff.
I think that's where I'm at, actually, on Patreon. I think I have 30.
Wow.
I don't pursue it. It's a weird thing to say, hey, give me money. I'm not... Ugh.
Hey, but, no, give me money. That's fine. I don't mind saying it. I'm quite happy to say. In fact, I'll sell you podcast sponsorship in return for money or any other kind of thing, as long as it's legal. But yeah, I take your point. But this guy actually works for Google as well, so he's like a 3D specialist or something. So he's not wanting for perhaps a few quid anyway. But it's stuff that he does is really good, and he's got a great workshop, great looking workshop. Right, well, I think that's probably a good point to end. It feels like a natural... Robbie, yes.
One thing, because I know you're not going to cover it because it's run out of time, but when you talked about the modular, a semi-modular thing.
Ah, yes.
What's a good semi-modular? I was just going to say, I think looking out there at the moment, the best option is the Kilpatrick Phenol, and I think I'm going to get one.
Ah, right, this was the question. It's been lurking in the show notes for a couple of months.
Yeah. And I was just wondering, because I was thinking of getting one. I've literally been talking about getting one yesterday. So, I thought
okay.
I would mention that.
Good point. Yeah. And the question was, what would be the best semi-modular you would recommend now? And I think Ed wrote a great piece on it. We got the Dope for Dark Energy. What else was there? There was a few others here. The Microbrew, obviously, that's a good one. And stuff that which has patch abilities. Korg MS-20, yes, obviously. I think the Phenol's there. Yes, there we go. There's the Phenol. Yeah. Let's see what other choices there are. We could finish it. Oh, yeah, the Boomstars, which are sort of, they're not quite mod, but they do sound bloody great. And what's this one? The Workstat, the Moog Workstat. And what else have we got here? Ah, yes, the Dreadbox Erebus, which I'm hoping to get in for review soon. Hold on, there's a couple more. What's this one? System 1M, the Iris System 1M, which does have some modular business on it. So that's a good one. And what's this last one? The last one. Ah, the Dominion 1, which I'm a massive fan of. Although when this got put, someone said, I had it and I didn't get on with it. I just can't believe how that's actually possible. How you cannot get on with it. But that's just horses for courses. Anyway, so thank you very much, everybody. That seems like a good place to end. I want to say thanks to everybody in the chat room, the Fulsome chat room. We had a really good amount of numbers in today, so thank you very much. And it doesn't look like we had any spammers in. I don't suppose, unless the bot that had been put in place just got rid of them immediately. I don't know what he did, but it was pretty good. So thanks to Dan in the chat room for sticking around and kind of adding extra value. He's very kind of him to do that on his own time. That's super kind. And also thanks to our sponsors. Remember, if you want to enter the competition, Isotope, you've got to tweet out the hashtag excellent audio and the hashtag ozone6 with a 6 to @SonicState and @IsotopeInc, and we'll pick a winner next week, and you could win an entirely free copy of ozone 6.1. I mean, wow. Anyway, thank you very much. I want to say, Gaz Williams, thank you very much for joining us. You've returned to high fidelity, which is awesome. Thank you very much for joining us this week, and been a pleasure. And also, I'm sorry we couldn't get Rich in. But anyway, I guess he had problems. I can see there's a couple of messages there, but I couldn't quite get to him while we were doing this. But anyway, also Mr. Mark Doty from the Bog Mobile Foundation. Thank you very much, Mark, for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you, and we may look forward to getting you again.
Thank you for having me.
What are you working on at the moment? Have you got any output coming up?
The next thing, I am furiously trying to finish the ARP Odyssey. I've almost run out of Prophet 6 and Leipzig videos. So the ARP Odyssey is coming next.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mark. And you can check him out. What's your YouTube channel? Is it Automatic Gainsay?
Yes.
On YouTube. Right. So check him out. And also Mr. Robbie Bronneman over there in the West Country. Thank you. Are you back for a bit, or are you off back to the States again? What's going on in your world?
No, not States again till August, but we're kind of out most weekends with the old summer festivals thing. So.
Ah, yes. So get out the wellies and the waterproofs.
Oh, hopefully not. Last year we managed to dodge the rain every weekend.
Excellent.
Last weekend while we were in America, there was a festival we couldn't do, and that was absolutely pissed down. So I'm hoping that we're kind of playing this game to see how many we can dodge the bullet on.
Right. Well, good luck. If you want to see, I'm sure there are tour dates available at all the usual outlets. Anyway, thank you very much, everybody. That's it for this week. And it's a wrap, so I will fade to black, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.